It will produce at least 120 kilograms of uranium with 20% enrichment annually at Fordo and store it inside the country. There are other steps all taken to revive our rights and respond to Europe's lack of commitment.
The new legislation was proposed in the wake of the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which Iran blames on Israel. Tel Aviv has long been openly trying to torpedo Iran's nuclear energy program. The Israeli regime was also implicated in the targeted killings of four other Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
The footprints of Israel cannot be cleared in this case. Mr. Fakhrizadeh has been the number one target of Mossad for two decades. And recently, there are reports that the weapon collected from the site of Tiris Act bears the logo and the specification of Israel military industry, and Israel has not commented on the issue yet, but it should brace for serious if for attack from Iran.
Iran's change of tone toward the nuclear deal came in 2018, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the multilateral accord. Iran has also been criticizing the European parties to the deal for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. Last year, Tehran began a stepwise suspension of its nuclear obligations to make the EU keep its side of the bargain.
This last move by Parliament is the boldest countermeasure Iran has taken to, quote, keep the balance between its obligations and rights under the accord. They say this way they will unlock the shackles placed on the country's nuclear program and pursue the goals of assassinated nuclear scientists like Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines now on the verge of being rolled out insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
We'll be right back. Iran, Cuba and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Qasem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the US should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal? Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Minister's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
The Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Debate.
In this edition of the debate, we will look at the abysmal human rights record in Saudi Arabia and how member countries of the so-called international community continue their dealings with Saudi Arabia, one of their initiatives being economic gains.
7 out of the 9 European countries which have appointed human rights ambassadors have criticized the continued detention of women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. In a statement, the ambassadors of the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Estonia, Luxembourg and Finland call for the release of all political detainees in Saudi Arabia.
We remain deeply concerned by the continued detention of at least 5 women rights activists in Saudi Arabia. Peaceful activism and advocating for women's rights is not a crime. We join the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, special rapporteurs and treaty bodies in reiterating our call for the release of all political detainees, including women's rights activists.
The envoy especially drew attention to the cases of 2 activists, Lujain Al-Hathloul and Samar Badawi. Hathloul was put on trial last Wednesday after 900 days in prison, but her case was transferred to the specialized criminal court. That's the institution that Amnesty International says is used to, quote, silence dissent. She is charged with attempting to destabilize the kingdom for defying Riyadh's ban on women's driving 1 month before it was officially lifted in June 2018. The case of Badawi, who had also campaigned against a driving ban, was earlier sent to the same court. Along with the European Human Rights Envoys, Chairman of the US House Intelligence Committee Adam Schiff has also called for the immediate release of the activists. But both the Europeans and the US have so far only paid lip service to the Saudi suppression of dissent and other gross human rights violations. Saudis have a long list of violations of human rights. They have led a deadly crackdown on the decade-long uprising in the oil-rich and Shia-majority eastern province, especially in Qatif region, where protesters seek an end to discrimination and political marginalization. That's beside what Human Rights Watch calls infringement on freedom of expression, association and belief, as well as migrant workers' rights. Riyadh has also helped Bahrain quash the 2011 uprising for democracy, supported an armed Takfiri terrorist in Syria, and has been leading a bloody war of aggression on Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children. But silence has been Western countries' reaction to Riyadh's role in Bahrain and Syria. And in Yemen, the West has encouraged and supported the Saudis by continuing to sell the kingdom the arms it uses to kill civilians. These are besides sweeping the Jamal Khashoggi case under the rug after the US Central Intelligence and the UN clearly linked his murder to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Riyadh appears to have carte blanche on abusing human rights, which limits Western reactions to his crimes to occasionally strongly worded statements. Actions, however, remain lacking thanks to Europeans and the US's lucrative trade deals with Saudi Arabia.
Joining us for this edition of The Debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. We have author and academic Lawrence Davidson joining us from Westchester. I'd like to welcome you both. Lawrence Davidson, I'm going to first start with you and just pretty much ask you a very, very simple question. Saudi Arabia, human rights, what comes to your mind immediately?
Well, what comes to my mind is a dictatorship that uses religion as a cover, and the economic resources it has to essentially buy the silence of everybody else. There's other things that are going on here, and it's not only the economic deals that you've mentioned in the introduction. There's a reluctance on the part of the international community, which is a nation-based community, to seriously interfere in what they consider to be the internal affairs of other countries. And this is an age-old principle. It started to break down after the Second World War, and the example we got with the Holocaust and the Stalinist concentration camps that he ran in the West, and so that started to deteriorate. But now it's back. So the reluctance to have anyone interfere in another country's what is considered their internal affairs is something that holds back these countries from going beyond strong statements. And it's also what underlies vetoes in the Security Council and that sort of thing. So it's got a history to it.
Okay, the reason why we have this topic for this debate, Daniel Lazar, is the case of five women, which has been highlighted, especially with these five European countries, for example, who are deeply concerned about their detention, because right now they've been referred to the Special Criminal Court for terrorism and national security. One of them is this lady by the name of Hathloui, who was targeted because of a law barring women from driving, which later, obviously, that law was annulled. So tell us what you think that somebody was detained for that is now in a court, a special criminal court for terrorism and national security.
Well, I mean, Saudi Arabia is quite simply the most undemocratic country on the face of the earth, and that includes us, North Korea, other terrifying dictatorships. But Saudi Arabia is in a class by itself. First of all, the country is wholly owned by the Al Saud, the House of Saud. It's really their private property. They treat it as their private property. They monopolize political power, and they simply do not grant the slightest rights to other people who live there. In the case of this woman who was arrested, it's a classic example of what happened in Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, knew he had to loosen the regulations on banning women from driving for purely international reasons. He did so, but at the same time, he clamped down on women agitating for that right from within, because he can't tolerate any kind of challenge to his authority, no matter how mild, no matter how circumspect, even if he agrees with what the challengers are calling for. So it's a total dictatorship, a total crackdown, and one which allows for absolutely no free expression by individuals outside the royal family. And even within the royal family, I might add, there's a reign of terror that prevents any kind of criticism of Mohammed bin Salman or his father, King Salman.
Well, Lawrence Davidson, you mentioned the economic gains here. I'm looking at the fact that you have these five European countries that have come out and made these statements. But what is the checklist when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia? I mean, when these countries like the U.S., like the U.K. or France, take a look at this checklist when it comes to the issue of human rights, well, they're going to go down and see, well, you know, people are being put in jail, there are sham trials, and there's a war that they're killing people in Yemen, for example, and yet they're dealing with them. They're dealing with the Saudi regime, going to the G20, giving them, again, another stamp of approval, of acceptance in the business community, per se. So that kind of sounds like double standards when it comes to the so-called international community.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're looking for morality in international affairs, it's not there in any driving or practical way. After the Second World War, lip service was paid. It was thought required to be paid to human rights because of the horrors of the Holocaust and other genocides that were coming down the line and all this sort of thing. So you had the international community, particularly Western countries, taking a verbal stand against that. But when it comes to diplomatic relations, when it comes to economic profit, okay, all of these countries, one way or another, they have internal important companies that are making money off of Saudi Arabia, and so they feel that they have to maintain that double standard. And again, it's the history of international relations that in fact you do not bring morality into it in any serious way. Here in the United States, there's been a long-standing debate between idealists and realists. Realists are those who, you know, want to dispense with morality when it comes to international relations, and they generally have won the argument. It's not a surprise. And I don't think it's going to change under Biden, certainly. And this is the way it is until we can resurrect some sort of, you know, standards of morality for international relationships. International law seems presently dead in the water.
Well, there was almost a total embrace when it came to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince Daniel Lazar, when he introduced his reform agenda. I mean, you have headlines like the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, power behind the throne. And then there was a shakedown that happened where you had all these wealthy businessmen, some of them princes, at the Ritz-Carlton, alongside people being jailed, And then you had the assassination of Khashoggi, which was in the worst way with the dismemberment, etc. So what happened to the reform agenda? I mean, you know, when we talk about the way that Saudi Arabia is still being embraced, whilst it has committed these atrocious crimes that are in the human rights arena, it's basically giving it a stamp of approval to continue dealing with it.
Yes, yeah, so you've got to bear in mind that not only is Saudi Arabia the most undemocratic country in the face of the earth, it's also the sick man of the Middle East. Its political institutions are in disarray. Its economy is a wreck thanks to the fall in oil prices. MBS's attempts to diversify the economy have gone nowhere. And the reign of terror that MBS is conducting will eventually backfire and will eventually lead to his own doing. He's a dictator isolated in his palace. He's surrounded by enemies on all sides. It's only a matter of time before he falls. And if he falls, there will be chaos. So that's what the Western countries, the so-called Western democracies, are trying to prevent. They're trying to uphold the Saudi regime by all means possible. And so if Mohammed bin Salman makes some kind of gesture towards reform, the U.S., Britain, France, etc., all cheer wildly, all in the hope that there's somehow this story will have a happy ending. But it won't. The regime can only crash and burn. It's profoundly unstable. Its days are numbered. We don't know how long it'll last. It could be days, could be years, could conceivably be even longer. But the handwriting is on the wall. This is a regime slated for self-destruction.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Lawrence Davidson, about an issue that many are not aware of, and that is the suppression that happens in the eastern Qatif region where the Shia minority actually live. And we need to talk about that because these people are being suppressed. And also, at the same time, we can compare that, the suppression, to what's happening to the Shias in Bahrain. So here you have these two brothers, namely Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, suppressing the Shia population in their countries. What's your take on that?
Well, these particular dictators, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, have been raised within this Sunni Muslim sect to see Shiites as dangerous, as heretics, and this sort of thing. And now, and in Saudi Arabia, you've got this sort of weird kind of situation where it's Shiites who work in the oil fields in the east, and so they're constantly under observation and suspect. So essentially, because the Sunni rulers expect or see the Shiites as dangerous and heretical, they expect an uprising, and so they suppress them and create the conditions for an uprising. It's not an indication that these guys are thinking things through. But it's an ideologically driven kind of hatred that they have. And so it's not surprising that the suppression of the Shiites in Saudi Arabia is longstanding. It's not new. And periodically, the Shiites react in stronger ways or less stronger ways, but it's ongoing. And it's certainly not surprising that the Saudis intervened to support the Sunni minority regime in Bahrain. So in both cases, they saw it in their international, they see this in terms of their internal interests to maintain their own dictatorship.
Daniel Azar, another thing that Saudi Arabia has been really critiqued for is this Sharia law, but not that the way that Sharia is practiced. Not that Sharia in Muslim countries that practice it is something that's bad. But because a distorted version of it has been adopted by one of the worst entities that actually spelled danger for much of the world, and that was for the Daesh terrorists, who adopted this type of ideology in their own warped way. And many said that perhaps that emanated from Saudi Arabia. Do you see that being, that Saudi Arabia is guilty somewhat of that?
Oh, of course. I mean, listen, since 1979, the takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, the Saudi royal family has been determined to burnish its credentials, its Islamic credentials, by exporting its own brand of Islam, which is a brand known as Wahhabism, which is extremely harsh, extremely intolerant, and which enforces a very unforgiving form of Sharia. So what we've seen throughout the Sunni world since 1979 has been the Wahhabization of the Sunni world. This is evident from Indonesia to the suburbs of Paris. And this has had a dramatic effect, and it's wreaked havoc both within the global Muslim community and also in terms of that community's relations with the outside world. It's promoted a very xenophobic, inward-looking, anti-modernist point of view, which has been disastrous for Muslims first and foremost. And of course, it's also driven the conflict with Iran. Bear in mind, anti-Shiism goes to the heart of the Saudi regime. In 1803, I believe it was, the al-Saud launched an attack on, I believe it was Karbala, in which thousands of Shiites were killed. And so this strain of belief goes way back as far as the regime is concerned. And so the al-Saud, the royal family, has placed itself at the disposal of the United States, which has used them as kind of their Praetorian guard to police the Middle East and impose a kind of a Wahhabist conformity throughout the Middle East in order to marshal opposition to Iran and its allies.
And finally, my question to you, Lawrence Davidson, you said that the incoming administration, if confirmed, once confirmed in the U.S., is going to carry on as business as usual. Why do you say that? You don't think there will be a change in the way that it approaches Saudi Arabia, especially when it comes to things like the war in Yemen?
Yeah, well, my position on this is that economic relations with Saudi Arabia will continue as usual. It's much too lucrative for the economy, U.S. economy, which isn't in very good shape, to not do that. So Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, particularly in terms of economics. Now, with a proper amount of pushing on the part of the more progressive elements, and maybe some of the people that he's actually bringing into the State Department and the NSA and what have you, we might be able to push him to withdraw U.S. support, active support, for the war in Yemen. There might be still U.S. naval ships in the area that help it in the blockade and what have you. It's likely that we can encourage Biden to remove that kind of support for the Saudi war in Yemen, but there will be no breakage of economic or diplomatic relations and this sort of thing, unless the Saudi prince oversteps his bounds. The killing of the journalist, which happened in another country, albeit in a Saudi embassy, but still, it happened in another country, in Turkey, And Khashoggi was an American, had an American green card. And so that kind of behavior is comes very close to overstepping the bounds and requiring some sort of reaction. Now, he got away with that, at least with the Americans this time. If he tries that again, or if there's repeated examples of that, then he's going to get into trouble in the international environment.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, I have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar, thank you for your comments, and author and academic Lawrence Davidson there with his comments. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitalov, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Epic of Eight-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the implementation of the paragraphs of UN Security Council Resolution 598 after the acceptance of 1975 Algiers Accord. Thus, the Iraqi forces pulled out of the Iranian soil and the POWs were exchanged. Therefore, then, UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Coya put paragraph 6 of the resolution on the agenda, which pertained to the initiator of war and the aggressor. The UN chief, after reviewing the documents of Iran and Iraq, named Saddam as the initiator of the war. The declaration of Iraq as the aggressor was a great victory for the Iranian nation. Paragraph 7 of the resolution was also important. This paragraph explained the damages inflicted upon the two countries. Therefore, due to the determination of the aggressor, it was Iraq which had to pay to Iran. following a series of negotiations between Iran and the UN Secretary General for implementation of paragraph 7 of the UNSC Resolution 598, a UN delegation headed by the deputy of UN Secretary General Abdulrahim Farah arrived in Tehran on May 31, 1991. The delegation took several trips to Tehran within 6 months and traveled to different parts of Iran to take aerial photos and examine the land closely. The UN delegation prepared two detailed reports on the damages caused by Saddam's army and delivered it to the UN chief. Dekoya handed the report and the result on determination of indemnity to the UNSC. According to the report, 5 Iranian provinces had been involved in the war and 11 other provinces were attacked by the Iraqi army. 50 cities and 4,000 villages had also been harmed in the war. Totally, 2/3 of the Iranian population had been subjected to the war. The UN report had made it clear that Iraq had cut 500,000 date palms and had carried out massive destruction on the Iranian soil. The UN delegation estimated the direct damages of Iran to be $99 billion and the indirect losses to amount to $150 billion. But the Islamic Republic of Iran announced its losses to be $1,000 billion. Although the amount of Iran's losses was officially announced by the United Nations, the UNSC Resolution 598 had not designated any mechanism for payment of the losses. Saddam invaded Kuwait 2 years after the end of his war against Iran. This move urged the Western and Arab regimes and media to admit some of the realities that they would not think of revealing even years after the end of the 8-year imposed war. These media confessed that the financial aid of the West to the Ba'athist regime in Baghdad not only contributed to the fire of war, they resulted in myriads of crimes and heavy losses during the war. The London-based Daily Observer, admitting the funneling of financial assistance to the Iraqi regime by the Western and Eastern regimes, wrote on September 23, 1990, that if the Saudi regime, along with Europe and Soviet Union, had not dispatched military forces, equipment and money, Iran would not have sustained that much of losses and damages during the war. Voice of America said on February 12, 1991, that it was Iraq and not Iran that enjoyed massive military and financial foreign helps. These helps enabled Saddam to create a war machine. 8 years later, when ceasefire was set up between the two countries, the Iraqi army exceeded 1 million. This means that the Iraqi dictator had managed to quadruple his military forces within 8 years, while the money for this was secured by the Saudi and Kuwaiti regimes. Not only these two regimes bought the Soviet Union, France, West Germany and Japan, and the United States of America had also assisted the Iraqi regime. Voice of America, in another report on September 28, 1990, disclosed the U.S. effort for removal of the Ba'athist regime in Iraq from the list of the sponsors and supporters of terrorism. It said that in 1983, the U.S. deleted the name of Iraq from the country supporting terrorism. Then suddenly, international credits and commercial helps started to be sent to Iraq. Christian Science Monitor divulged Washington financial credits to the Ba'athist regime and wrote that in the years 1985 to 1990, the U.S. Bank of Exports and Imports granted $260 million credit to Iraq to
to maintain its needs from the U.S. The Daily put the securing of financial needs of the Iraqi regime by the U.S. in the years 1987 to 1989 at $1 billion. Another part of the confessions were related to the U.S. role in the chemical crimes of the Iraqi regime. British Daily Herald Tribune, quoting from Arthur Schallinger, aide to the former American President John F. Kennedy, wrote on December 17, 1990, that while Saddam was going to launch such an operation, meaning chemical attack, the loans granted by American banks to Iraq for purchasing of agricultural products amounted to $1 billion. In addition to the Western governments, Arab regimes too, through their full support for Saddam. The Voice of America reported on February 12, 1991, that the Persian Gulf Sheikhdoms secured nearly $30 billion, more than half of Iraq's financial needs. The fabricated Zionist regime's radio revealed on July 23, 1990, that Kuwait had given billions of dollars of aid to Saddam in the war against Iran. It made it clear that Saddam had borrowed approximately $60 billion foreign loans to continue the war against Iran. At least $40 billion of this money had been given by Arab regimes, including Kuwait, which gave $14 billion. Voice of America also said that Kuwait, in order to support Iraq after 1986, overloaded the global markets with oil in a bid to prevent the oil price hike from $15 to $17 per barrel and decrease Iran's oil revenues. Kuwaiti economic expert Fawaz Badr said at a conference in UN on December 7, 1990, that Kuwait had helped Iraq almost $15 billion. He stressed that this support was apart from the assistance in terms of oil. The Saudi regime was another supporter and comrade in crime of the Iraqi dictator Saddam against the Islamic Republic of Iran. The financial assistance of Riyadh to the Ba'athist regime in Baghdad were so high that the Saudi defense minister in those days, Khaled bin Sultan bin Aziz, said, "My country would provide the drinks of the Iraqi army." VOA reported on August 14, 1990, that the Saudi regime had given billions of dollars to Saddam in the war against Iran. Associated Press, too, on the same day, quoting the Saudi monarch Fahd, said, "If Iraq says that it has sacrificed its forces, we have also been involved with money, advanced weapons, and international cooperation." The Saudi state TV, in a report, admitted the regime's financial aids to Iraq, saying, "Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and United Arab Emirates granted their entire financial aids to Saddam during the war." On January 15, 1991, Reuters, quoting Fath, announced the exact figure of Saudi regime's financial aids to Iraq as $27 billion in form of the military and economic assistance. As for the Western regime's aids to the criminal Iraqi ruler, Saddam, during the eight-year imposed war, one of the Western media wrote, "One of the NATO bases in the center of France was the place of loading Antonov aircrafts of the Iraqi Air Force. These aircrafts would take cluster bombs, fuses, and radar equipment to Iraq. The French spying apparatuses estimated in 1986 that if Paris would quit its aids to Iraq for 3 weeks, Iraq would be defeated. Thus, during the eight-year imposed war, the Iranian valiant youth fought not only against Saddam's army, but against scores of its supporters in various parts of the world who were complicit in each and every crime that the Iraqi army committed."
Good morning! Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.